Hello, I'm Carol Waddis and this is Theatre Voice. This afternoon we're talking to Michael Walling. We're sitting in the Soho Theatre in the centre of London, and Michael is a director who believes in cross-cultural exchange. He spent the last 15 years trying to map a different way of working from that in the West, with a particular interest in Asian culture. As an artistic director of his own company, Border Crossings, he directed productions that have travelled all over the world. His latest production, and now at the Soho Theatre, is called Reorientations, which is the last in a trilogy which started with Orientations and was followed by Disorientations. Reorientations uses a dizzyingly eclectic cast, which includes Indian, Chinese, Swedish, as well as British performers. Michael, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Hello.
First, I want to just ask you about Border Crossings and how on earth your company got started.
Really, it was a response to a series of things that happened to me. I was working in the States in the mid-90s. I was doing a production of Romeo and Juliet, and this was shortly after Ming. And I thought it would be interesting to key the play into what was going on the West Coast. And so, you know, it's not blazingly original, but the Montagues were all white and the Capulets were all black. And the extraordinary thing was that we had death threats and radical right were in action. And I mean, I didn't take the death threats too seriously until the police found the guy who'd made them and found the arms cache.
Can we just remind people about Rodney King?
He was the
cop, was it? Was he?
No, he was the black man who was beaten by the police,
right.
And that led to the riots in LA. Around about that time.
Right, and this would be when?
It was about 1993, I think.
Right.
And that production was seen by Mahesh Dattani, who's a very interesting playwright from India. And in response to that, he invited me to go to India and do some work there. So having already started to touch on areas around culture clash, in the work in America, I found myself doing a Shakespeare production in South India, and that was the first time I'd been outside the Western world.
And
it was an extraordinary experience, because having, you know, I'd directed quite a lot of sort of rather classical work up until that point in my life, and of course The Tempest is also a classic play, but in India it takes on so many different connotations.
Yes.
I mean, it felt like, well, Caliban, after all, is actually a Sanskrit word. It means the black man.
Does it?
Yeah.
Never
so he was coming home.
Right. Yes.
And it went on. Yeah.
Yes.
And I started to realise there's a lot of the assumptions I had been making about my own culture, about the theatre as a form, and about what theatre was capable of doing, were actually very, very limited. And so really, I think Border Crossings was created in response to that set of experiences. I wanted to develop further and to discover more about how we could work in dialogue with other people. And the world during those 15 years has become ever more globalized.
Yes.
And so, you know, the urgency of what we're doing actually has become stronger and stronger during the time.
And what had you done before? Had you had a fairly kind of conventional theatre directing?
Well, I'm not sure there is such a thing as a conventional theatre directing path. I'd run a company called Stage One for a few years, which was a touring company in the UK, and we had done, well, there were certainly more text-based pieces, which were sort of fairly mainstream English, I suppose. I'd done quite a bit of Shakespeare, and I'd been invited to, you know, America to do Shakespearean work. So, yes, I guess it was more conventional.
And you'd taken production with the blessing of British Council, hadn't you? Was that
not at that stage,
not
no.
That stage.
But the British Council and I first started to talk, actually, in India. It was all part of the same thing.
Right, right. Okay, so Border Crossings was formed in, or founded in...
1995.
And what was the first thing that you did with Border Crossings then? What was your first thought about what you wanted to do?
Well, one of the first things we did was actually a play Mahesh wrote, which was called Bravely for the Queen. It was an Indian play, but we opened it in Leicester, and then brought it into London. So, yes, Bravely Fought the Queen was quite an early one. We did a number of sort of scripted pieces in the first few years, and then started devising around about 2000 with a play called Mappamundi, which was a sort of millennial piece looking at imperialism and mapping.
And was that mostly with a British company?
No. By that time, we'd started becoming quite diverse, and we brought... because we'd done a production of Twelfth Night, the only time Border Crossings has done Shakespeare, we did Twelfth Night in 97 to 98 at the request of the British Council, and that went to Mauritius and to Zimbabwe. Partly as a result of that, we were able to bring actors from both of those countries and from various other places to work together on Mappamundi. I don't think it was our most successful work ever, but it was the start of something quite important in terms of allowing very, very different people from very, very different theatrical backgrounds to come together in the same room and just starting to see what sparks flew when we did that.
But what you'd seen, as I understand it, when you were abroad, was that theatre could be something far bigger and broader and richer than just text, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
That you saw that in Indian theatre
and
in African theatre too.
Yeah.
That is, in Indian theatre, it has a huge dance component. The cross-gendering is something which is part and parcel of that, and that in Africa, of course, there's an enormous storytelling and various other factors.
I'd
just like to tell me a little bit more about how you thought you could incorporate or make a different kind of theatre.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much incorporating. I think that's where a lot of intercultural work or cross-cultural work fails, is that actually it becomes rather imperialist. And, you get Western white directors going out and poaching something and taking it back and saying, we'll have a bit of that. And, that's robbing the wealth of another country, and that's really not what we're about.
Mm.
I think it's much more interesting not to take something from overseas and bring it in, but actually to try and make a space where the dialogue is completely between equals.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite hard to do.
Yes.
That's the objective, I think if you can do that, then actually you're pointing the way through art to the way the globe should be going, and so rarely is. So it wasn't so much about an incorporation as a realization of what we could learn from each other, because I think there are many good things about Western theatre, and after all, that was what attracted me in the first place to the theatre.
Yes.
I think we're very good at storytelling in a broad sense. I think we're extremely good at subtle psychology, subtext, the creation of structure and narrative. I don't think we're good at transcending ourselves. I don't think we're good at making visible the spiritual, the luminous, the invisible, even the dream world.
Yes.
And I think those things are much more imminent, much more present in virtually every other culture. There does survive, in spite of the fact that we're now post-colonial, there survives a very strong sense, I think, in the West that, that's because they're all rather primitive. And it is so not true.
Mm.
And the reality is that we can learn an enormous amount. And the reason that the West is in such an appalling state, politically, psychologically, is that we've lost contact with the much more complex emotional, spiritual, psychological lives which human beings should be leading.
Mm.
And we've become driven by a very, very narrow range of vision. And so I was interested to try and learn more about those other sides of humanity, and to try and make a theatre which addressed that. And at the same time, allowed us to think about the fact that we are now all living in the same world, and so these dialogues are actually politically and socially necessary as well as theatrically exciting.
Very much so. Very much so. Do you remember? I remember when I was at university, a book by Anton Arto.
Yes.
I forget the name of
the theatre and its double.
Yes.
I believe.
And I mean, at least half of that book was actually about him discovering
Balinese theatre,
rather in the same terms that you're describing about the spiritual, but also about dance, about dance. But of course, his idea was that the theatre, by looking at that, that it should become the theatre of cruelty, that actually theatre should shake the audience to such an extent that there's a kind of a really cathartic explosion. The way you're talking, that's not quite the kind of idea that you're after, is it?
Well,
or is it?
Well, in some ways it is. I mean, Arto is someone who I admire very much, though I don't think what we're doing is quite what Arto wanted to do.
Certainly not when the show that I saw.
No.
With kind of reorientations.
But I think what Arto was thinking about was, in many ways, he was returning to Greece through the medium of Bali. I'm not sure that he read Bali quite accurately, in fact.
No.
But I do think his take on the Greek theatre is absolutely accurate, and that it was a violent and savage form, but it was also a form that was sung and was danced. And that was what enabled the rationality of Athenian democracy, was that, you know, everybody went to this extraordinarily visceral event as a preparation for the legislative process and for jury service. You actually go through song and dance and colour and vibrancy to take you to another plane, which just opens up thought in a different way.
And we've really lost that connection, haven't we?
Yeah, we have.
Never mind about the spiritual connection. That's very interesting to be reminded of that, Michael.
Because it's more holistic, you know. And we talk about the spiritual as if it lives in a little box somewhere and we're a bit embarrassed about it. But actually, the spiritual, the physical, the musical, the imaginative, and the legislative and the rational actually have to all come together. And, you know, I think our processes of social and political, and never mind economic, being have become so bogged down in the minutiae of rationality that we've forgotten that actually they're supposed to be there to bring about things like, well, what Jefferson called the pursuit of happiness, which is a very emotional concept.
Yes.
You know, it's got nothing to do with rationality. And if those are our values, then why are we approaching it through numbers?
Yes.
You know, we need to approach it through a much more open and, wild form.
Yes, yes. No, that's lovely. Tell me about, let's just start to talk then about orientations and this. How old, Reorientations is the latest piece. When did Orientation start?
2003.
It's a long, seven-year journey.
Yes, I mean, we didn't know at the start that this was what was going to happen. I mean, when we started work on Orientations, which was again in Bangalore in 2003, we thought we were doing a one-off play, I was interested, again, I think in response to the earlier journey to India. I was interested in the way in which the traditional Indian forms had retained cross-gender performance and how that read back into things like Shakespeare and the incredible radicalism of what he was doing with the boy actor. And again, something that's been completely lost from most Western theatre is that ability completely to transform the self through the imagination of the audience and the power of the actor. And so I wanted to do a play which dealt with that, but which also dealt with the breaking down of old binaries in the modern world, you know, so, you know, East and West, male and female, you know, straight and gay, and to look at the ways in which actually human interaction is much more fluid than those ways of thinking tend to suggest. And that's where Orientations came from. And then while watching it one night, I realised that one of the ends, which we had deliberately left open, had the seeds of a second play in it. And actually the idea of the third play came almost immediately after the idea for the second one. So that was around about 2004, 2005. And we made Disorientations in 2006. Then there was a bit of a gap, and now part three has finally materialised.
And when you were doing, when you started, did you have an idea of what the storyline was going to be? And who was in the first one? Who was in Orientations? Was it, again, an Indian, Chinese, British, Swedish cast?
No, it wasn't. Orientations was set in India, and we worked with Indian actors and English actors. The only survivor of the original company, apart from me, is Radhakrishna. Who is a Yakshagana performer from South India. He's been playing women in Yakshagana since he was five.
Yes.
So it's very, very much in his blood and his body.
Yes.
He's been... Well, he wasn't in Disorientations.
Right.
Because that was set completely in China.
Right.
And we worked with the UA Opera Company from Shanghai, which is an all-female form.
Yes, I saw that in the programme. You've got a very strong female element.
Yeah.
When I saw Reorientations two or three nights ago, I was very struck that there is a very strong female component there, and particularly the fact you've got a lesbian story. I mean, embedded in there. It's quite unusual. There's a wonderful line in it where you say about the main character's song, who actually we don't realise, for those of us who have not seen the other two parts. This wonderful face comes up at the beginning, and one doesn't quite know who that character is.
But until quite late in the play.
You've got this wonderful line about what a brave thing she's doing, and it gives you such a kind of a jolt.
Mm.
So tell me how the storyline developed from... Because there is a through line, isn't there? There's about a young girl in the first part, Orientations.
No, she... Well, the young girl who's in Orientations is...
Linda.
Is Linda, yes, who comes back in Reorientations. Yes, I suppose there is a link in the story. But you don't have to have seen the first plays to see the third one, and it's very deliberate that they all stand separately. When we first... And both Orientations and Disorientations are very, very distinct, really. With the third play, it was harder because inevitably some of the characters were going to continue out of number one and number two, and we wanted them to coincide, and that was how we started. And for a while we thought we were going to try and do all three. In fact, for quite a long time we thought we were going to try and do all three, but it's an unbelievably expensive business.
Well, So we
ended up with the third one. And so what we had to do after having done our first work on Reorientations last year was we then had to rethink it in the light of it having to become a standalone piece, which is why there's that allusion you just talked about to Song at the beginning and to Alex's death.
Mm. Song being the Chinese woman who has an affair with the young British girl,
Alex. Yes. The Julian and Marie's daughter.
Yes.
Yeah. So we had to bring in a bit of that backstory. Actually, it wasn't that hard to do, and I think Reorientations does now stand alone. If we were ever to do all three, actually we would have to cut some of the stuff from the beginning of the third play and rework the order of scenes or something, so as to, because then there are actually scenes repeated from the second play, and it's only, well, there's a scene repeated from the second play.
So tell me how the first one,
how it came about.
It's so
long ago I can't remember.
Well, tell me then how this one, because I imagine that the process now is not set, because clearly
with your
work nothing is set, but you get your actors together, they've got different languages, they've got different skills, and at the end of it you've got to have a piece of work which might have a connection to the two other pieces that have gone before. So tell me how that works.
Do you do
workshops?
We all got together for the first time in Shanghai.
How do they communicate?
In many ways. In many ways. I mean, it's very similar to what happens on the stage. Because with this sort of work, a lot of the time, the play becomes about the process through which you made it. And devised work is always, to some degree, about the people who are in it. And so scenes like... there's a scene between the young Chinese man, Sammy, and a Swedish actress, Maya, which takes place in Starbucks. And it's essentially what they improvised, because he doesn't understand what she's saying half the time. She doesn't understand what he's saying half the time. And of course, we distilled it down a lot from things that had happened. But the comedy of misunderstanding just was naturally present in any case in the room. So there are advantages to having people who don't understand each other, and you know, the battle for communication, which is after all what theatre is about. Is something which is very real in our work. So that's part of what we do, is actually to tackle that question about how do you communicate? And one way is just attempting to speak each other's languages. One way is through movement, and movement's very, very important. Mm. Every morning when we were in Shanghai in early 2009, we started with 1 to 2 hours of movement work. Mm. Because that's something where everyone can meet, you know, you all have the body. And doing that is actually a very strong way into people being able to communicate through through physical means, through the eyes, through touch, through music. It's quite hard to describe, but actually as time went by, it became quite easy for people who didn't share a common language to work together. I would start to suggest various exercises which could lead us down potential storylines or into potential scenes. Like, for example, I was interested in that we had the title at the start, Reorientations, and you know, the idea of that was interesting. So one day I asked everyone to tell someone else in the company a story about themselves being in some way reoriented. There was an interpreter. My associate director's bilingual person, so she was able to help between some of the Chinese people and the non-Chinese people, and by and large we sort of worked it all out. And then the person to whom the story has been told then tells it back to the group as if it's their own. Mm-hmm. Now what's interesting about that is it goes straight away through a cultural filter. So if an Indian person has told a story about, you know, something that happened to them when they were growing up in Karnataka to a Swedish person, the Swedish person then has to tell it back to the group as if it's a story about them growing up in Gothenburg. So the imagination comes in, and it may mean that the story becomes radically different, mm-hmm. but it is still rooted in some sort of autobiographical fact. But it becomes veiled and fictionalized, and then if something interests us that comes out of that, we will start to make scenes about it. Or actually, I think on that particular day what I asked people to do was to take two of the stories and put them together in one scene, and material from that particular exercise is in the play. And there are many such things. It was all a case of finding ways in which might work. We found quite early on that the Western actors tended to talk too much when improvising. So on about the fourth day, I think I imposed the rule that all the scenes we were going to do that day would not have any words in them. And that was a very good moment. That was a big breakthrough.
Yes.
And of course, also the whole problem of communication instantly vanished.
Yes.
And there are now quite a lot of scenes without any words
yes.
in them.
Yes.
And it's fine.
Yes.
You don't need them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then occasionally you have words with scenes with lots of words in them, and that's fun for a different reason, because you start getting rhythms and a different kind of music emerging in the play.
There's lots of dance. Well,
yeah.
It's not dance, it's movement. And
yeah.
right at the very beginning where you have the cast doing a movement to, I think there are, if I remember rightly, there are illustrations, there are back projections going on.
Yeah.
And I wasn't at all sure what the actual movement was about, but it was very mesmerising to watch. And that was all the cast doing it.
Yes.
I didn't quite know what the message was, but I was certainly gripped by what they were doing and, you know, the projections. behind.
Well it's interesting that you're looking for a message, because you know, maybe there isn't one. But it was, where it actually started from was we made that piece of movement originally about the tsunami. It's not specific to the tsunami at all, but what we regard it as being about is the way in which human beings are now washed up in the sort of detritus of the aftermath of the 20th century, and how Alex's suicide, which is what you're seeing on the screen at the same time, is a part of that. That's and that the characters are caught up in a form of drowning in the same way that she is. But it's deliberately not made rational and explicit, because you know, it's Asian.
So we're not
theater.
Supposed to take a particular specific meaning, as it were, from that moment.
Well, I don't think.
Certainly,
I don't think that's.
There was
how
a feeling I had.
Yeah, well,
I couldn't
feeling
have told
is
you
the thing. Yes.
What the meaning was, but there was a definite feeling coming through.
Well, I think the feeling is the meaning. Mm. You know, I don't think we have. This is what we were saying earlier. Mm. Why should we pin things down with rationality?
Mm.
You know, it's. I think there is a clear emotional power in the moment, and
but it's still important in a piece of theatre, isn't it, that you take the audience with you. Insofar, I do still think narrative is important.
Yes, it
isn't
is.
It?
Yes, it is.
You still need
absolutely.
To have that that backbone for the feelings to move around.
Absolutely,
don't you?
Absolutely, yes, yes, yes. I couldn't.
And so, have you always paid attention to that? I mean, in the what we're seeing in Reorientations, from the way you're describing it, but maybe not, is that they're all taken from real moments that the cast have perhaps experienced.
Well, not
but
not
you wouldn't go
it.
That far. Would
no,
you?
I wouldn't, and certainly not all of it at all. But there were useful pegs.
Yes.
But you know, there have been many, many other ways into creating the storylines.
Yes.
And of course with this play, in some ways it was slightly easier because we knew that it was about the aftermath of something which had happened in previous work, and we knew to a degree who some of the characters were emerging as being, and so that gave us quite a lot of start points and possibilities for playing around.
Well, now let's get down to one or two specifics. One is that I'm very interested in, well, a couple of questions, Mike, but let's just take the first one, which is I'm interested in the music and how you chose the music. The first piece, as you told me, is just absolutely beautiful while they're doing that movement and there are projections of her committing suicide. And it's Beethoven, is it?
It's Beethoven's, I think it's fifth,
absolutely
piano trio,
piece.
And its nickname is The Ghost.
It's, oh, really?
Yeah,
ah.
And... the idea of ghosts was very important in making the play. In fact, the idea of ghosts is very important in the theatre, full stop.
Yes.
Because you know, we are able to bring the past to life in some sense in the theatre, and I think a lot of this performance and many performances that we do is about the presence of history as something which is shaping our lives and holding us.
But then you jump into very much more rock.
Yeah,
I mean, just give me some of the names of those pieces of music that you've chosen. Just rattle off if you can remember.
Well, do you know what? I'm really not very good at remembering them.
No,
there's an Icelandic piece of rock music in there. There's some Chinese rock music which is used in the club scenes.
Yes.
Which is by the winner of the Supergirl competition. Who's a very interestingly androgynous figure, known as Chris Lee, would you believe, in China. There's Pink Floyd's Shine On You Crazy Diamond.
Maybe that was one that
which, of course, was written for someone who had committed suicide. So quite often we arrived at choosing the piece of music for... those kind of reasons, like, oh, it's called The Ghost, let's look at that and see what. Or sometimes it was pure instinct, and Denise and Misha, our choreographers, had an iPod in the workshop room, a very, very full iPod, and sometimes we would be improvising, and usually Misha, who has an encyclopedic knowledge of his iPod, would press a button and a piece of music would start and it would fit. Quite a few just came like that, which is why I don't always know even what the name is.
No, again, it's to do with mood in some way.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It is. And then there's a couple of pieces by John Adams from quite early, when he was more influenced by rock than he is now, from his Hoodoo Zephyr album.
Well, I thought the music was absolutely smashing.
Oh, well, good.
Also, what I enjoyed very much, I'm just going to put a little question to you here now, because I was reminded very much in the pacing of the piece and the delicacy of the moments, and what you were trying to achieve on a smaller scale. I'm going to ask you about funding in a moment, with Lepage, Robert Lepage, who of course has a similar idea, A, about finding, putting people into a workspace and seeing what emerges.
Yeah.
A lot of kind of cross-cultural, a lot of webcam and a lot of video projections, usually beautiful music, which I think is normally written though, and obviously on a much bigger scale than yours. Do you know his work? And
I do.
You been influenced by him at all?
Well, I think I probably have, yes. I admire Robert's work very much, and I don't know if you've noticed in the programme, but Tony Guilfoyle, who plays Julian, has collaborated with Robert quite a bit over the last 10 years. I think clearly there's some sort of synchronicity going on there.
Well, I thought of Lepage, I thought of Simon McBurney and his
good company, you know.
You are
kind of
Complicité and Shunkin and the other pieces that he's done.
Yeah.
There's a young company called Gob Squad I saw in Lyft this year,
right,
who again were doing an amazing amount of work with webcam.
It's interesting.
So, yes.
I mean, I would add to the list Tony Kushner. Certainly Angels in America. Arianoush Keane. And it's interesting that quite a lot of these people are francophone, you know, and I think the French have a very different way of relating to the wider world than Anglophone people. And both Ariane and Robert, and actually even Simon McBurney, who after all has very strong connections to France, have a much more open approach to interculturalism than British artists.
It's the pacing, which is so beautiful. It actually pays the audience the compliment of allowing your imagination, allowing your mind to think.
It's essential.
Being bombed over their head and being told, here's a scene, here's the text, here's the mute. You know, you actually allow somebody, you allow an audience member merge themselves or immerse themselves in that particular moment, you know, for a moment before we actually have to move on.
I think
that's a wonderful compliment.
Well, I think it's extremely important that that we do that. I mean, again, it's to do with the religiosity or spirituality of the Eastern theatre, where, after all, in India, you know, a performance can go on all night.
Is that what you're aiming for?
Well, you know, if we did the whole trilogy one day, maybe we would. But I think, you know, the fact that Robert's performances are getting longer and longer is not unrelated to
that. I think the next one's is likely to be 13 hours.
I think Tony was saying 12. It's long anyway. and I think it is to do with, well, it's like Wagner, and I think I directed The Ring for ENO a few years ago, and I learned a lot from that about exactly what you're talking about. That if you go on to a slower rhythm and you create a space, you know, like the opening of The Ring does, where it's just opening people out and you get this kind of mantra-like
sound.
You're able to breathe.
The audience starts breathing.
And they go into a slightly different level of consciousness.
Yes,
it's not the hectic thing of, you know, running down the street, well, what's my next text message? Where's my next meeting? It creates a space where you can be different and special, and that's what theatre has to carve out for itself.
Two final questions, very specific. Funding for the work that you're doing, how do you raise the money for it? Because it's quite anti-capitalist and therefore it's quite anti-commercial.
So where
are you getting your money from?
Well, the largest funder for this project at the moment is the European Union. And in 2007, the EU put out its first call for proposals for what they call collaborations with third countries, which means non-European countries. And they were very specific. They wanted either China or India. So we put in an application for something with both, because, you know, that's what we were doing and wanting to do. And we were lucky enough to get that. And of course, when you get a very large grant from the European Union, then other grants follow. The Arts Council, the Commonwealth Foundation, the Swedish Embassy, you know, have all been very generous. So that's been very helpful for this. But we have to start every single time from nothing.
And for the future, because you've now, this is the final question, because we're running slightly out of time. You've now got this marvellous sounding festival that you're
the Origins Festival.
Tell me a little bit about that and how that will be funded then.
Well, yes, it's a very good question. I mean, the Origins Festival of First Nations, the first time we did it last year in 2009 was the largest funder was the Kellogg Foundation from the United States, and they were very clear that was a one-off grant and they wouldn't do it again. So we've just got to go out and look is the short answer, and I'm sure we'll find something eventually. But we're not a core-funded company, although we have just received a grant from the Esme Fairbairn Foundations, which means we will have some funding for staff from the end of this year.
That's going to be a huge help. Really, really helpful for that.
Well, it's a quantum leap for the company, actually.
Yes.
It really is, and after 15
years. Tell me
a
little bit about what the festival is.
We call it a Festival of First Nations, which is, First Nations is actually a Canadian term for the Indigenous people of Canada, but we liked it more than Indigenous, because everyone's Indigenous to the planet.
Yes.
But there's something about you know, the group of nations who are now minorities in the
country. So we don't say native anymore, do we? Native.
Well, because it carries over terms of nativism and whereas First Nations, I think, has a kind of respectful sound to it and a sense of a people who live in a very long continuum of history, which relates to some of the things we've been talking about earlier. And I'm very interested in those cultures as because they can teach us huge amounts about what we're doing to the planet and, you know, what we're doing to our families. And
we're using language as a part, aren't we? Every day or every week we're losing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the preservation of ancient cultures with ancient wisdom seems to be very important.
So will this be held in London, hope?
Yes, yes.
And it will be this year, next year, 2012?
We don't quite know. We did one in May 2009. I'm hoping there will be one in 2011. It's to do with an alliance with another festival, which seems to be going quite well, but we need the money. Failing that, well, 2012 is a busy time in London,
it may be
a good moment, it may not be.
And how many companies took part in the first festival?
There were 5 theatre companies, 4 performing and 1 running an amazing workshop. And there was also a film festival with 30-something films. Endless discussions, comedy, ceremonial, an exhibition. It was quite a big thing.
Well, we shall look out for it. Good luck. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed. I've really enjoyed that.
Thank you.